RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Time for another health hacks this Monday morning here at RCR. Dr. Glenn Davies, reversalnz.co.nz, back with us. Hi, Glenn, how are you?
Hey, I'm excellent, Paul. Thank you for having me back.
Oh, anytime, Glenn. Come on. And if we didn't, we'd have howls of, where's Glenn? Where's Glenn? I don't want to go through that. I don't want to put myself through that. Or Liz, who clears all the emails, she wouldn't want to go through that either. So, no, great to have you back. I thought we could do something a little different today because we've ranged over so much in our chats for, well, it'll be on a year now, wouldn't it?
I think it is, Paul.
Yeah, so, and I don't know if we know enough about you. So I thought we could chat a bit about that this morning, kind of the life experience behind, you know, where you are now and, you know, the knowledge that you have and just through a career that spanned long enough to kind of see some things, you know, and really sort of pull that knowledge together and help a lot of people. And Reversal NZ is obvious there. So do you mind doing that?
I don't mind that at all, Paul. One of the things I've observed about myself is I do seem to, through my career, have kept more of that overview or helicopter view on things. I've tried not to get bogged down in the details, which I think tends to prevent that sort of creative thinking.
I agree with that. Helicopter view is a good term. You need to stay connected, but at the same time, you need to disconnect slightly as well, right? So you get a perspective and see what you are doing at the you level is working, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think what's happened with keeping that helicopter view, it's allowed me to see some of the problems in the healthcare system and the things that I've tried to do my little part to fix.
Are you still as enthusiastic about medicine, you know, compared to the day you, in fact, we could ask you about that, when you decided to embark on this career? Is it more than a career?
The generation of doctors before me, I think it was a calling. It was a profession and it wasn't a job. One of the things that concerns me about the current generation, the generation that's coming through, they're definitely viewing it more as a job. And it's hard to practice medicine as a job. You know, it has to be a combination of both of those. This new generation is looking more at work-life balance, which is good. I think that's true across most careers, isn't it? But mm-hmm. I think medicine is a calling. It's a profession. It's not just a job. And as soon as it becomes just a job, it will lose status and effectiveness.
I can relate to that because I kind of see what I do, and I don't want to sound like, you know, overblown on it, but as a calling in a way. You know, someone has to help in the process of communicating ideas and information, and some people are better at it than others. And, you know, when you do your time, you kind of figure out a few things. So I don't mind, actually, a lack of work home life balance in the cause of that. I'm prepared to sacrifice a degree of that, not all of it, but a degree of that, because I really feel like I need to be doing this right now. There are other people who can do it, I know that, but it's just right now it's me, and I'm willing to go with that. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, and I think I am as well. We've talked on a health hacks before about A goals, B goals, and C goals. Not seagulls as the ones that fly around, but seagulls. And an A goal is something that's attainable and realistic. But these seagulls are so ambitious that they look impossible until you start working on it, and then you get a glimmer of hope that it may actually be possible to change some of these things which seem absolutely impossible. And that's my why. I work within a pretty much a broken system. I think general practice or primary care is to a large extent broken, and I can see how it could be fixed. And my goal is to be part of that solution. And sometimes it just seems too hard, and it would definitely seem easier to just, go and sit on a beach. But I don't know, I think maybe it's not actually a goal, maybe it's a goal, and we can actually achieve a better version of the healthcare system. And that's what I'm absolutely passionate about, and think that collectively we can achieve that, but there's a lot of work to do.
So trained in New Zealand, Glenn, good training, was it?
Well, that's a leading question. The University of Otago is certainly an excellent university, but my biggest criticism is that they left out the most effective part of the training, which is a training in nutrition. Apparently, we got 6 hours training in nutrition, and I think it should have been the biggest part of the course, because medical nutrition therapies are the most effective tool in medicine. So was it good training? It could be better. Apparently, we get trained in something like 174 medical conditions, and those medical conditions haven't really changed since the beginning of time. But the conditions that we're dealing with have changed dramatically as we've moved from this infectious disease era, things like the plague and leprosy, into this non-infectious disease era where we're dealing with type 2 diabetes, obesity, hypertension. Yet we're still learning in medical school about the same 174 conditions that we used to. So there's as much emphasis on tetanus and leprosy as there is on diabetes, whereas we're dealing with diabetes. One of our kids who's learning medicine at the moment said, but doesn't everyone in hospital have type 2 diabetes? And it's like, shouldn't we be spending 50% of the medical curriculum on these modern non-communicable diseases? And do we need to be spending as much time on TB, tetanus and leprosy as our predecessors did? So we still have to learn about these conditions, but the emphasis needs to change, and the emphasis hasn't changed enough.
That view on nutrition, did you come to that, or were you already primed thinking that way when you started your training?
No, this was something that came much later. It was about, I think, about 7 years ago, and I was at the General Practice College, or the General Practice Conference, and I listened to Professor Grant Schofield from AUT talking about the fact that diabetes can be reversed with nutrition. And I went, I've never heard that before. Diabetes can be reversed? What's this crazy idea? Surely it's
revelation.
A chronic. Yeah. It was a revelation. I believe that diabetes was a chronic, irreversible condition that eventually led to blindness, limb amputation, dialysis, and insulin injections. And here was this professor standing up and saying, no, it can be reversed. And then the next lecture, the lecture after that was from a bariatric surgeon who said that bariatric surgery can reverse diabetes. And I was going, whoa, this is this crazy bombshell. Where is this coming from? And then soon after that, there was a paper that came out. It was called the DIRECT trial. And it was putting people on an 850 calorie a day diet, and 46% of the people in the trial reversed their diabetes. And there was these light bulbs popping up everywhere, these daffodils popping up out of the ground, yeah. These beautiful little pearls. And that's really what my last 8 years have been based around, the realization that it can be reversed and trying to work out how to do it in the best way. Because I realized that an 850 calorie per day diet is not going to be ideal, because that's not sustainable for most people. I realized that bariatric surgery, it certainly has its place, but that's not going to be the solution for most people. So I came back to sort of Grant Schofield's pearl, which was a low carbohydrate or ketogenic diet can reverse type 2 diabetes. And that's what I've based the rest of my career around.
And you've seen it happen, right?
Yeah. So I've personally witnessed, and I've kind of lost count now, but it's around 200 people where I have monitored and have results, and I can say categorically, you know, in a medical journal or at a conference that I have seen this number of people reverse their diabetes. But, you know, we've supported, you know, probably around 4,000, or it's actually 4,400 people on this journey. And I can't quote those because I don't know what number of those, you know, 4,500 people have reversed their diabetes, but I estimate that it could be as much as half of them. So,
wow.
You know, my estimate is that, you know, maybe 2,000 people who I've been associated with have reversed their type 2 diabetes or pre-diabetes, which is a revelation to come from the place that diabetes is irreversible and ends up with limb amputations and dialysis to, hey, this isn't that hard. You know, make some changes, cut out sugar, reduce your carbohydrates. You know, sometimes I've even sent people a text and said, you're in the pre-diabetic range. Why don't you stop junk food and soft drinks? And, you know, 3 months later, they've got a normal HbA1c, and I've gone, well, that wasn't so hard.
No, all it took was a text. Yeah.
Yeah.
Gosh, if life could be so easy.
It's not always that easy, by the way.
I know. But you'll take those ones when they come along, I'm sure. Now, I remember at one point in one of our chats, and there have been lots now, you mentioned time in Papua New Guinea. And I'm wondering what that experience did for you.
Yeah, it was a joyful experience to work in that environment and to have a whole lot of experiences that I wouldn't have had and shouldn't have been allowed to have in the Western world. You know, I the funny part of the story is I went there expecting to be the obstetrician and gynecologist. I just finished my diploma in obstetrics when I went there, and I arrived and they took me to the ward and they said, here's your ward. And I said, what are all these toddlers doing in this ward? And they said, oh, didn't we tell you, this was before the internet, of course, didn't we tell you you're going to be the pediatrician? So after me studying my guts out to learn how to be the obstetrician, I arrived to find out that I was actually the pediatrician for the first 3 months, which was a shock. But I did focus on obstetrics and gynecology and did a whole lot of surgery that was amazing. You know, the classic stuff that you hear in these stories of sending down to the workshop to get the drill sent up and sterilizing the drill bit and drilling burr holes in people's heads. And,
oh, crikey. Gee.
Draining pus out of the pericardium, which is a sac around the heart. And how you do that is you put a needle in and you attach an ECG lead. And when you've gone a little bit too far, the ECG starts firing. So you pull back a little bit to know that you're in the pericardial sac and actually removing pus from the pericardium. Ooh. There was, I think I've seen TB in virtually every organ of the body because TB was really big over there and we had a TB ward. And I've seen it in bones and lungs, of course, but in virtually every organ. And there are a whole lot of abscesses. You know that TV program, Pimple Popper?
I think so.
we could have done an amazing Pimple Popper show because it wasn't little pimples, it was huge abscesses, you know. So, we got to do heaps of really cool stuff. I got to walk right across the island of East New Britain. We experienced the cargo cult, which
I've heard of that.
So what it was during the Second World War, planes used to fly over and they would drop, cargo in parachutes. And so, of course, the local people had never seen a plane and certainly never seen these presents dropping from the sky. And sometimes they were really useful things and sometimes it would be a jeep, you know, which is of very little use without fuel or instructions on how to drive it. But it birthed this whole religion, I guess is the right word, the cargo cult, where if you prayed, things would drop out of the sky. So it's created this very unusual culture in these areas that you walk into. So I experienced that. I experienced, you know, really life, what it must have been like for very, very traditional people, you know, living in, literally living in mud huts, sleeping around the fire on a dirt floor, very, very minimal food. So, yeah, very, very cool experience.
What did you make of, would you call it a primitive society? That's probably a little insulting, actually, but a very basic one, and probably one that hadn't changed for, I'm picking, hundreds, thousands of years. What were your impressions of the way that folk lived in that situation?
Yeah, like, my impression is that life was hard. You know, the housing, like, it was huts made out of mud, like dome huts made out of mud. And the reason is that once you've farmed an area for a season, you have to move your gardens to another fertile area. You know, so they had to move their villages frequently. And so there was nothing apart from these huts. People were in shorts and T-shirts. They walked to get water from the river, and that was about it. Yeah, and this idea that although life was hard, people were happy. In these cargo cold areas, I didn't think they were happy. That's really what surprised me.
Ah, okay.
They were, and I think it might have been this cargo cult mentality that had created this wanting for more than you actually have. You know, my idea around traditional societies is that there wasn't this wanting that we have now that creates this unhappiness, but the cargo cult had, I think, created that desire for more, but the inability to achieve it. Yeah, it wasn't happy, those areas.
It's like a form of consumerism.
Yes.
But, you know, not the one would come to mind first, but in the end, that's probably what it is.
Yeah, yeah. So I found that interesting. Whereas the area where I was living was on the coast, beautiful, happy people, you know, kids running around. You'd walk down to the shop, and by the time you got there, there'd be sort of 20 people walking with you.
Oh,
say,
wow.
Where are you going? Oh, I'm going to the shop. And they'll just start walking with you.
Can
like
we
all
come?
These kids. So that was lovely. Yeah, that part was lovely.
And some of the experiences that you've had, a volcanic eruption, I believe. What happened there? We know it's a highly volcanic area.
Yeah, a huge privilege. I got to see a volcano erupt from just sitting there as a dormant volcano to exploding. So the story was a volcano that was probably 30 kilometers away on the other side of the harbor had erupted, and it was puffing away. And, you know, there'd be occasionally some big rocks and lava flows and stuff, but it was a long way away. And we had got up early in the morning, beautiful crystal clear morning to watch it, and about 15 kilometers away on the other side was another volcano called Vulcan. And while we were watching, sort of, I think 6:30 in the morning, like literally, and sometimes it sounds like exaggerations, but literally the side of this volcano exploded before our eyes, and this massive shoot of dust, you know, came out. And then the whole entrance to the harbour between these two volcanoes started erupting out of the sea. And,
wow.
And it went from this crystal clear, beautiful day to so much ash in the sky that everything went dark. And we were videoing it, and there was all this excitement, everyone talking about how pretty it was. And then the whole side of this mountain, 15 kilometres away, erupted, and the audio on the video went from everyone being excited and is there petrol in the vans? Can we get out of here?
Yeah.
Has anyone got a boat? You know, like it was quite extraordinary. And during that time, there were 200,000 people displaced. The government hospital was closed down, and everyone from that hospital was evacuated to our small mission hospital. So that was a 450-bed hospital, moved to our 250-bed hospital. And we looked after people. I don't think I slept for the first 3 days. We performed surgery after surgery after surgery for those 3 days, as as the trucks of people arrived from the government hospital. We had the orthopedic ward was evacuated on the back of a truck. These were all people in traction, 8 hours on a potholed road in the hot sun to arrive. The babies in incubators arrived without any mothers or staff. They had been on the back of a truck for sort of, I don't know, eight hours. It was carnage, really was. But, yeah, we coped.
Yeah. I've seen Mount Ruapehu erupt. That's about the only one. But I was up close for that. And there's something awe-inspiring about that sort of Mother Nature power. It really does, you know, kind of blow you away if you've never seen it before, because it's just next level, isn't it, really?
And what we experienced really was next level. There were a few funny parts. The volcano observatory with a lot of international volcanologists ended up covered in ash, and they lost all of their surveillance equipment, but they had a phone. So they would ring us and they'd say, "What's happening?" We'd go, "Oh, there's a plume of ash going 60,000 feet into the air, and there's red rocks the size of VW vans getting shot out and rolling down the side of the mountain." And then you'd listen to the national news and they'd go, "We're just interviewing the head volcanologist and he's saying there's plumes of ash going 60,000 feet into the air and rocks the size of VW vans." We're going, "We just said that."
yeah. You just reminded me again, you know, when that that big eruption happened in Tonga a couple of years ago, I heard the, I guess they were sonic booms. There were six of them. I heard them in Auckland. And no thunderheads around. And then found out about 2 hours later that it was actually the sonic booms of that eruption. Yeah.
Incredible. Mm-hmm.
What about lifespan in that part of the world compared to here?
Yeah, people, I don't think people were living as long, and I think that's probably because the nutrition was poorer. Well, and when I say the nutrition is poorer, you know, that's interesting, isn't it? A lot of the people ate this root vegetable. I don't know if it was more like a parsnip or a taro. They called it Singapore, and they would just bake it in the fire and get up in the morning, the fire had died down, they'd peel the ashes off and they'd eat it. And sometimes that was all they would have in these higher mountainous regions. So even though it was whole food and natural, it was really, really deplete in protein and vitamins. When I say their diet wasn't as good, now we've moved into this new form in the Western world of malnutrition, which is eating the ultra-processed food, again, which is low in vitamins, again, which is low in protein, and again, which is low in healthy fats and vitamins and minerals. But, you know, we've got this whole range of this ultra-processed food. So we've gone through perhaps the heyday of nutrition, which might have been around our grandparents' time, where they had really good access to meat, fish, chicken, and good quality vegetables without the introduction of these ultra-processed foods. Now we've moved back into this new era of malnutrition where we're not malnourished in calories, but we're malnourished in nutrients. So we're seeing obesity and malnutrition at the same time from eating these
bizarre,
these hollow foods. And when you look back at that Singapore, that root vegetable, it didn't contain very much. And it's very similar to the modern ultra-processed foods, which don't contain much in terms of minerals and vitamins and nutrients, but has enough calories just to keep you going.
Right.
You know, so, yeah, we've gone, if you imagine a bell curve, I think, as time's progressed, we've gone from malnutrition through the heyday, and now we're back to malnutrition with obesity. You know, people there were malnourished and looked like the people that you see on the, you know, the adverts for Ethiopia and stuff.
Yeah.
You know, there were a lot of people that looked like that. Now I think we've got the same amount of malnutrition, but people are overweight and obese, which is fascinating, isn't it?
It is. Talk about reversal. New Zealand GP of the year 2021, is that true?
Yeah, so So a real honor. People ask me why, and I think I just had the best PR team because I was nominated by Precure, which is Grant Schofield and Louise Schofield and team, and also by the Australasian Society of Lifestyle Medicine. So I think I had a really high quality nomination. But it was acknowledging that work that I'd done in reversing diabetes, which I don't take credit for because it's the people that are doing the hard work, isn't it? You know, they're the ones that have to make the changes to their diet and their exercise. But it was acknowledging that. And I accepted the award, you know, not out of arrogance, but accepting that award gives you a bit of a stronger voice. And it allowed me to talk more widely on this topic that I'm passionate about, the fact that you can reverse these chronic diseases with nutrition. Yeah, so that was in, I think it was March in 2021. And then the irony of that story was at the end of 2021, I became unemployable. So that's kind of... rags to riches, or the other way around, riches to rags, isn't it? I was unemployable.
Is there more detail on that you're prepared to tell us about? Or
yeah, so I had developed uncertainty around the COVID-19 vaccines. I'd followed it very, very closely during 2021. Very early on, I'd done a risk calculator that the Oxford University had put out, where I'd calculated my own personal risk of dying from COVID-19 if I got it, acknowledging that I put a lot of effort into my personal health. Using this risk calculator, I had determined that I was very low risk of dying. So I went, okay, I don't have to have it to protect myself. But the difficult question is, particularly as a doctor, did I need to have the COVID-19 vaccine to protect others? This whole issue of transmission. And I'd followed that very, very closely. And by the time I had to have that or lose my job, which was the last day of 2021, the 31st of December 2021, we had very good information, particularly coming out of the UK, that the vaccines were having no impact, or if any impact, very limited impact on transmission. So I had by that stage concluded that I was personally at low risk, but also that my decision to have the vaccine or not would have very little impact on transmission. So I made the very, very difficult decision not to have the COVID-19 vaccine, which resulted in me losing my employment. I didn't lose my practicing certificate, but I lost my employment. I was a little bit surprised by that because we had demonstrated right through those lockdowns that it was possible to practice remote medicine for a large number of cases. And I was in a big practice with 11 doctors and nurse practitioners. I felt that having one of those doctors working remotely would be a reasonable thing to do, but that was not the conclusion of my employer. So I was dismissed.
So you're GP of the year 2021, and then come the end of 2021, you're unemployable. Again, we're in clown world again, I'm thinking. Well, interesting to hear about that, but obviously that hasn't held you back because, well, you obviously came back from that. What happened after that?
So being unemployable or not being able to be employed in the mainstream meant it gave me the opportunity to do something different. And that's where with three business partners, we established Reversal NZ, which was a private general practice, which initially we operated remotely, doing Zoom consults. And then when the mandates finished, we were able to do face-to-face consults again. And that really allowed me to experiment with this new model, a different way of doing medicine based around lifestyle medicine, where we focus on nutrition and focus on exercise and the other levers of lifestyle medicine supported with health coaches. So we established this whole different version of primary care. It was outside of the system, so it was entirely and continues to be entirely privately funded, which meant that all of the compliance that goes with accessing the government funding wasn't there. So we were able to get rid of so much of that admin that takes up so much time within a standard general practice. So we didn't do any of that. We just asked people to fund it privately. I was able to offer 30-minute or one-hour consults. It was supported by a whole number of health coaches, and I think we did a really, really good job and continue to do a really good job of offering people who can afford it a better version of the healthcare system. So lifestyle medicine supported with health coaches, and you know, we sort of work with people to change their own health. Rather than this paternalistic view of the doctor tells you what to do and you have to decide whether you do it or not, this is working on the client's agenda, and it works really, really well. And I have the joy of practicing medicine back within that environment.
That's so cool to hear. I'm relating to this because it didn't quite get to being unemployable for me, but it would have if I'd stayed any longer in the conventional media, being a mainstream newsreader. And I know about that calculator that you use because I used it for me too. And I was very low risk, as it turned out. I tried to tell people about it, but they weren't interested in listening that it was available. But I bailed because I didn't like the way we were messaging this whole thing. That's another story. But what I found, and this is the point, is that the way things have turned out, it's been better. It's been better. I'm so glad I stuck to my guns, and it was pretty grim at the time. And I thought, well, that's it for me. You know, I had a great time in the media, probably over now. No one's going to look at me. I'm a black sheep, all that sort of stuff. But actually, no, that was just the start of something even better, actually.
Yeah, and I think what we've both been able to demonstrate is integrity, and the ability to make a decision and stand by that decision, even when it gets hard. And, you know, to lose your income and your job. And I guess the biggest concern was, would I lose my ability to practice my art or my ability to help people, which is why I do this. And that was the biggest fear. And it turns out that I think I have now got more ability to help people than I would have within the mainstream system.
Is that irony? Is that ironic? What's the word for that?
I think that's the fact that the universe perhaps has a bigger plan for us, and sometimes we don't see the plan. And maybe we just sometimes have to trust that there is a bigger plan and sort of run with it. And you know, it's when you look back on it in retrospect and you sort of summarize it like that, it sounds easy, but these decisions for you and for me, Paul, they weren't easy at the time.
They were,
you
know, very awkward.
It was hard. And, you know, I think it took a degree of courage to just trust that there is a better way out there and have the integrity to stand by the things that you think are important. You know, in medicine, it was that informed consent issue. You know, I personally had the right to make an informed decision about whether or not I chose that medical intervention, and for me, it wasn't the right decision. And informed consent is one of the basic tenets of medicine, and I had to stand by that. And it turned out in that very, very early period, I was able to support so many other people who had made the same decision and were going through the most huge trauma, you know, losing their jobs, trying to get the trying to get the exemptions. You know, helping people with that process, trying to get the exemptions. People having to leave the country because they're having their visa was dependent on having a job, and they no longer had a job. People struggling, you know, school teachers particularly struggling with the moral dilemma of not being able to support their kids anymore. It was huge, and I was able to work with them and have met some incredible people with amazing courage and integrity through that process, which has spilled over into RCR I think collectively we're supporting people that have felt excluded, but probably now are increasingly feeling comfortable and perhaps proud of the decisions they made.
Yeah, I think since we've been chatting pretty well a year, it was all new. And I wondered, you know, we would talk about alternative systems for this and that, and it was all kind of pie in the sky. But now I feel that I can see it in some sort of way coming together, actually coming together. We're kind of, I don't know if we're inventing something new, but we're doing things differently, I think. Yeah.
And I've a similar thing with what Reversal NZ is. It was a different way of doing it, and in many ways a better way of doing it. But I was giving a lecture at a conference, and someone said to me, "You can't stand up and have that kōrero. You know, you've got half hour or 1 hour consultations. You've got people that come and see you because they want what you are talking about. You know, that's not the real world. Get back into the real world." And I went, "Actually, that's a fair criticism. You know, can I take these principles into a real life situation?" So the four of us, we purchased a very low cost access, so fully government funded practice in the rural North Island. And the challenge there is, can we take the best of the government system, and can we make this work in a fully funded system? And the answer to that question is, I don't know yet. We took over the practice in November, and my realization is what a lot of compliance, a huge amount of compliance is involved in obtaining these small little packages of funding, which allows it to remain just viable. And I'm pleased that we've done it, because, you know, I now have firsthand experience of this process. And stage three, and we haven't quite got there, stage three is, can we take the low compliance aspects of the funding and the Reversal NZ model, and can we start a practice from scratch that doesn't have the huge admin burden, but get some of that funding, plus takes into it all these principles of empowerment, nutrition first, medicine as plan B, health coaching, behavioral change, all of these concepts, and can we make it work in a hybrid model? So that's stage three. I guess stage four, if we get to a stage four, is, would there be other people that would want to take on this model and, you know, do it in their own practice, or even start a practice anew? So there's still a lot of work to do. And my overall ambition is to manifest and demonstrate a better version of the healthcare system. And it'll just be one better version, but hopefully people can take the best from that and then build something on top of that. So that's what I'm about. I think, yes, we've done it with Reversal NZ, but it's private, so it's not accessible to everybody. We're struggling a little bit in this small rural town because we're just trying to do the compliance stuff. We haven't even been able to get onto the helping people bit, but hopefully that'll happen soon. But, you know, my big ambition is, can we start from scratch, take the best of the funding and the best of what we know, and create a practice from scratch? And I guess the people that are probably our Reality Check radio listeners are probably the people that will be attracted to this, because it'll be about empowerment, informed choice, and everything else that we talk about.
Glenn, that's really been interesting, and I want to thank you for sharing this information, personal information, background information with us. How long are you going to do this, Glenn?
Yeah, you might be the same on this, but if you're passionate and joyful and loving what you do, why would you want to retire? You know, like, why would I swap the joy of walking beside people as they improve their health for croquet or bridge. You know, I hope that I will have the energy and the enthusiasm to keep doing this for a long time, and the health, you know, and part of this is keeping myself healthy, you know, like eating well, exercising, laughing. We live on a lifestyle property. I haven't gone and got the eggs from the chickens yet, but will soon. We just moved our two steers into a new area of grazing yesterday, you know, so that's what I'm about. And hopefully staying healthy and well, I will maintain the energy and enthusiasm to keep doing this into my 80s. It's, what is it, 80, 81 that you're allowed to still have, major influence in the world. So it looks like 81 might be about the limit, but So I don't intend to retire before I'm 81.
Really interesting chat. Thank you, Glenn. Yeah, great.
Yeah. Thank you, Paul. Thanks for having me again.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.